Welcome to News of the Money World, an informing, insightful, and inquisitive look into how news events from around the world affect us everyday investors. Your hosts are myself, Darcy Ungaro, host of the NZ Everyday Investor Podcast and qualified financial advisor, and Rupert Carlon, founder of Kura KiwiSaver, one of New Zealand's most cutting-edge, passively managed KiwiSaver providers. Every fortnight, 5:30 p.m. sharp, tune in live on YouTube or on Facebook. Ask some questions, provide some counterpoints, help influence the discussion. Now remember, all investing carries risk. We hope this helps you understand markets better, but please remember to do your own research too before acting on anything talked about here. Hope you enjoy today's show. Hey, welcome to News of the Money World. I'm Darcy Ungaro and Rupert Carlon. How you doing, Rupert?
Good. How are you, Darcy?
Very good. Very good. We were just chatting before the show, and unfortunately, we're chatting about something completely different. So we have no idea what we're talking about. But nope, hang on. We've got a little note here. Yeah, we're talking about property. What's happening with property in New Zealand? Is it all crashing around us, or is there hope, right? So we're having a chat about the state of the housing market in New Zealand. That's what we're talking about, right?
It is. And I've got no idea on the current state, but I've got done a little bit of research, which is good, and to figure out actually with some of the historical norms and going, actually, let's have a look at what happened historically to think about what this current cycle might mean for the rest of us.
Fantastic. No, that's cool. It's a good idea. Like, so I, you know, to start off with, I've been doing what I've been doing in the mortgage and in, you know, the financial advice space for about 20 years. I've seen two proper corrections. This one feels like there's a whole bunch of tension building up and it's just waiting for a catalyst, right? Whereas the GFC, the last big proper correction that I remember going through, that was a big catalyst. And the, you know, it was from the banking system outwards. So do you want to maybe start there, Rupert, and kind of talk about a little bit what happened in the GFC, perhaps, to talk about what the catalyst was for the last New Zealand housing market correction?
Yeah, so the GFC was a really interesting one, right? So what we saw during that period is we saw nationally property prices fell about 13 to 15% over a fairly short space of time. That happened between the period of kind of mid to late 2008 through to mid to late 2009. And it was it was the first retraction for a very long time after a very strong run up in prices. And that happened, and then that probably took, so some areas, so Auckland recovered very quickly, for example, that recovered about 6 to 12 months later. And then nationally, though, the average kind of didn't recover back till 2011. So kind of a similar period to where the stock market did. What was interesting over that period is the Auckland market probably fell the smallest. It fell first, but at the same time, I think their property prices only fell 9 to 10%, whereas in the regions, they fell significantly further. Mm. So I find that a really interesting period based on where we are today, because we are seeing Auckland clearance rates are definitely falling further and faster than anywhere else in the country. We know mortgage auction clearance rates at the moment in Auckland are currently sitting in that 20 to 30% rate versus 6 months ago where they're at 90, 95% plus. And we kind of, I think all the research shows that it's Auckland prices that are falling stronger. And so that's what's kind of paused me and made me do a little bit of work on this, because I kind of go, actually, what does this mean for the rest of the country? And what does this mean for kind of buyers and where we look long-term, right? It's a really interesting one where we sit today. What are you seeing as a mortgage advisor?
So I'm seeing it on the coalface, right? And I think this is why it's really important, perhaps, for people to talk to real estate agents, talk to financial advisors, talk to people who are actually walking the beat, you know, they're at the coalface of what actually happens. And things have been different, probably properly, since December, to be honest, but especially since probably the beginning of March. And I'm primarily based in Auckland, but I work all over the country, right? So I get a feel for this, and it's definitely changed. Activity is gone. You know, if you're a property investor, Most property investors are staying still, and actually everybody is staying still. And I think everything acts in a homogenous fashion initially. The property market kind of just falls away initially, but then as time goes on, I think we're going to see the different pockets responding a little bit different with these, with the price changes. But what were you saying around the last time where Auckland caught a cold and the rest of the country got a flu? My view is that Auckland might be getting a flu this time and the rest of the country might be getting freaking, I don't know, HIV mixed with COVID, mixed with cancer. I don't know. It could be real bad is what my concern is. I know it's quite extreme, but I kind of view most of New Zealand as a, in terms of pricing, house prices, as a function of what happens in Auckland. So Auckland shows us the direction and the rest of the country shows us how far things will actually go. So that's kind of what I'm seeing and what I kind of am expecting to happen, especially in light of what we saw, the Auckland diaspora that happened over the past, you know, 7 years or so, where everyone's moving out into the Bay of Plenty and everywhere else in New Zealand. I'm quite concerned about those areas in particular. Hopefully I'm dead wrong here. I really do hope I'm wrong. But that, to me, feels like probably the most at risk.
And that makes a lot of sense when you come back to the fundamentals, right? Fundamentally, a housing market has to be based on income and it has to be based on local market incomes. And I mean, this is one of the things, the big surprises for me is when I look at, so family members of mine looking at purchasing houses in Hastings or in Masterton and some of those other areas, and you look at the salaries and you look at the average wage in those areas, that's always what shocks me. So when we talk about historically, kind of being a five to six times income is a normal house price ratio. In Auckland, particularly some of the inner suburbs where you have much higher income families, I struggle to see that in some of those other parts of New Zealand. And that's where I agree with you. That's what's going to drive the big risks as well.
Yeah, totally. And it's like when you think about the how far things could go. I was having a look at the OCR today. We probably should have started with this, right? The OCR was increased today by 0.5%. We're now at 2%, which is exactly where the OCR was in 2016. And I have a lot of views on where the OCR is and what impact it will have, but like this is a really significant event, because my view is that basically you can talk about immigration and income and all that sort of stuff all you want, but ultimately it's interest rates that affect house prices in New Zealand predominantly. There's a whole bunch of other factors, but it's interest rates. And if we see interest rates on the OCR side, at least getting up to where they were in 2016, my big question is, are we going to go back to 2016 house prices? What are your thoughts?
I mean, it's a good simplistic piece of thinking, but fundamentally wages have gone up a little bit. So since 2016 to today, average wage in New Zealand has probably gone up by 6-7%, maybe 10% max. Population hasn't materially changed. So fundamentally, what does that mean? Yeah, I think you're probably, that's not a bad place to start, right? We should be looking at house prices being up 10-15% from 2016 numbers. But if interest rates are the same, there shouldn't be a massive amount of difference.
Yeah, and that's the weird thing. But there is a delay, because one of the weird things about New Zealand is that we have this interesting scenario where the vast majority of us are immune to the OCR right away. Yeah. We have this strange sort of rubber band situation going on, or an interest rate shock absorber to the household, where the OCR increases the official cash rate, but we're largely immune as households because a significant amount of mortgage lending in New Zealand is fixed. Unfortunately, about 3/5 is fixed for less than a year. So that part's not too cool. So we're kind of fixed, but we're not really protected. We think we're protected, but we're not. But ultimately, to me, it kind of feels like there's this distortion where the Reserve Bank kind of needs to put on the brakes, waiting for some feedback, but they don't get that feedback. So they keep on pushing harder, don't get any feedback still, push on harder, and then all of a sudden they're hitting a tree and getting a bit of whiplash, because there is this delayed impact with the OCR. So that's kind of what I just remember because even back in 2008, when the Reserve Bank initially, in my view, were quite slow to reduce the interest rates, it had quite a muted impact because a lot of people at the time were fixing for the cheaper, longer term fixed rates. So even though they tried to reduce the pressure, they were impotent. They actually had less effectiveness in the market because fixed rate lending is so popular. Like, are you fixed, Rupert, with your lending?
I am fixed. Not for as long as I would like. I've only got another 7 or 8 months left. But there's a couple of points here, right? First one is, so interestingly, Don Brash, the Reserve Bank governor, he's probably 3 or 4 Reserve Bank governors ago, he was quite vocal about the fact that for him, he would like to move it away from being an OCR conversation and move it towards being a conversation on adjusting petrol price increases. Because he was quite soon and ahead of his days in recognizing that actually mortgage rates were something that only impacted certain people. And more importantly, they took a long while to kick through. Whereas he went and requested whether he could actually have a view on petrol taxes, because that was something that was going to impact the majority of people on an everyday basis. So I think it's interesting, right? We've chosen a mechanic to adjust the flow of capital in and out of the economy. But actually, I guess, and I can't remember whether I spoke about it on this part or here or somewhere else, but actually I do wonder whether there are other ways in which we can kind of think about it, right? Imagine a variable rate adjustment on GST. So where we go, actually, is it 15%, 16%, 17%? That would be the quickest way in the world to adjust consumption, and that would make sure that flows through to everyone immediately. I think the second thing that does need a conversation in New Zealand is actually the competition in our finance sector. It is amazing that the difference between a spot rate, a variable rate mortgage, and a first 1 year fixed. And I think we're in a world where, for some reason, our variable rate mortgages are significantly more expensive than our fixed rate mortgages. And based on the interest rate curves, that should really not be the case. And so I think what we're finding banks that are using fixed rate as a way to make sure they lock in clients and lock them in for specific time periods. And so I think there's probably a little bit of something for the Competition Commission to have a look at as well, to let us actually get to the bottom of, hold on a sec, if we compare our uptake of variable rate mortgages versus fixed rate mortgages versus the rest of the world, why is it that in New Zealand we have a significantly greater portion of our population that are fixed than other parts as well?
Yeah. And there's so many strands to this that I'd love to go off and get distracted on, right? Like one of the things we've been talking about, inflation probably for over a year now, right? Talking about it's coming, it's transitory, it's not, it's permanent. Now it's here, it's definitely here. And interest rates are rising to the occasion to slow it down, to suck demand out. And I think the words of the Reserve Bank today was, we need to be dealing on the demand side while we have some productivity constraints, which I thought was an interesting statement, because it kind of actually inadvertently says where the real problem is, which is on supply side stuff. And if you're getting inflation on the supply side, being driven on that side, how effective is it really going to be by diminishing the demand side? Really, it's kind of like have nothing and be happy about it, because there's nothing to go around. That's kind of like the medicine that we're being given right now. But if there was higher productivity in New Zealand, or there is less supply constraints, more stuff for the money to find a home in, we wouldn't be in this position. What are your thoughts on that?
Look, I mean, we've talked about this before, and I subscribe a lot to the views of Mark Fowler and some of the other really interesting team here at Hobson. I mean, you got to look at total demand, then you got to break that down into goods and services demand. And then what we see is that goods demand is really gone skyrocketing over the last few years at the expense of services demand. What I was looking at this morning, what I was hearing on the radio this morning was how in Europe at the moment, you can't book a flight, you can't book a hotel over summer, because the tourism season is fully booked out. And so I do wonder, I think, how much of this, and I know we're not allowed to say the word transitory at the moment, but I think we have been in such a weird economic situation over the last 2-3 years. I do wonder how much of this is driving some of the decisions that we are making at the moment, and how much of this inflation is permanent versus transitory, and how much of it is driven by that significant increase in demand that's gone into goods versus services. Because I look, and that's why I'm a little bit, I'm very much more sitting on the fence and probably sitting on the angle at the moment of actually it's definitely time to wait and see. Because what we are starting to see out of the US when we look at the retail earnings, we're starting to see here in New Zealand when we look at more and more numbers, it seems that the economy and things are kind of falling far, far faster than anyone would imagine. I mean, you look at the reaction today to the Reserve Bank announcements, where the Reserve Bank here in New Zealand was extremely positive and made it clear that they were going to continue this fight on inflation. They, if anything, they lifted their kind of long-term inflation forecasts, and you saw the dollar strengthen, you saw interest rates rise, because that was far more positive than anyone else in the market had previously predicted. So, look, I find it fascinating, but it's just really, really hard to see here what's going on and unpicking the COVID impacts, the stimulus impacts versus the reality. It's hard, right? I'm happy to go on record and say also I'm not convinced that kind of when we do think one of the key drivers of inflation has been the cash payouts in the US, I'm not quite sure why we then went and did that here in New Zealand as well, of giving an extra cash payout to people in a high inflation environment where everyone acknowledges that was one of the drivers of inflation in the US and in the UK. That's what we've done here. So
That's a strange thing. You look at the way that the Reserve Bank of New Zealand has responded, and you put that next to how the Fed responded. Like, the similarities are just bizarre. Obviously, it's an event that affects the whole world. So that's kind of how I would look at it. But sometimes I kind of wonder: are they just singing from the same hymn sheet, and they're parking their brain for a while? They're just following a script, or are they actually thinking the problem through here? Because it feels like they're slow to the party and then they're too fast to the party at other times. And to me, it doesn't make sense. But going back to that phrase before, I think you mentioned that you were a little bit afraid of using the word transitory. I don't think you need to be transitory phobic about it, but I think that it is possible that the things are actually just what they seem. I'm actually increasingly of the view that maybe it is transitory. I kind of feel like this inflation really is the short-term symptom associated with central banks trying to fight off deflation in the form of which is being induced by technology and demographics. That's the bigger fear, I think, that they're trying to protect us from, or they're trying to protect the system from. But I kind of get the impression increasingly, like especially with seeing some of the data coming out of the US, that maybe things are actually turning a corner, and maybe the Fed over there and our Reserve Bank over here, maybe they may be justified in pulling back on the brake pedal a little bit.
But the issue is they won't do that, because I think the biggest criticism of those central banks over the last 3 or 4 years, over the last probably 6 to 12 months, has been that they acted way too slow and they didn't see what was happening. And I think what that does for them is I think they're going to have to see some really strong data before they're willing to go the other way. And I think that's what's quite scary, right? It's at the moment in the current environment, we almost need a central bank that's willing to be brave and willing to kind of make some of the tough decisions. And I just can't see any of the central banks making that.
I agree. Well, we just need any leader to be brave and actually think for themselves, in my view. But you're right.
You're asking for a leader and a politician to think more than 6 months out? All right.
You're right. Maybe I don't want
that's
that.
It's completely unreasonable.
Yeah. Well, it's scary because, you be careful what you wish for. You just might get a politician who's too good at telling us what to do. But I think with where we're at right now in the world, it seems to be a bit of a game about preserving the system, preserving confidence in the financial system, which I think, fair call, like that is actually really important, or else things start to unravel pretty quick. But what you said before around seeing some data, you're right. We need to see really clear data that the reserve banks or central banks can use to justify their position to backtrack. Otherwise, they're going to have egg on their face. Like, so much of this just feels like it's about credibility.
And again, that's what I kind of remember. I think we had this conversation maybe a couple of months ago, where a lot of the economists in the US were saying the Fed just has to go big, they have to go hard to protect their credibility. And that's, I think we are starting to see some of that, right? Because today's announcements was interesting, but I think completely, yeah, it was just whether that's about protecting the credibility of themselves versus the right thing. That's what I guess my concern is as to whether that's the right outcome. But I do think that also brings us back to why we started the conversation, which is around house prices. Because fundamentally, it comes back to one of the core drivers of where house prices are going to go is how far the Reserve Bank is going to go and how high interest rates come. And this is the bit that I haven't quite got in my head. And I'm an over-levered house owner in Central Auckland. So, of course, I worry about this every single day. Yeah. But I go, yeah, so the Reserve Bank will, at the end of the day, falling house prices is one of the sharpest and quickest ways to bring an economy to halt, because that means that people are petrified of spending. They can't do the mortgage top-ups. They can't do all of that kind of stuff anymore. But then it kind of turns into a pretty quick and cycle. But I personally believe that it has to come back to those core fundamentals, right? Housing is a supply and demand game. The supply of housing versus the demand. And that's the bit that I've kind of struggled with over the last kind of 18 months in particular. We haven't had population growth, but we've had this surging demand for housing. And that to me is what makes it brings back to it has to be an interest rate game and a cost of capital game. And as that unwinds, that means I think your basic analysis around, look, 2016 prices, is that where we're heading? I don't quite know, but I don't think it's a bad base case. Let's adjust that 2016 prices for average wage growth since then. And that's probably not a bad base case as to where it probably should go.
Yeah, interesting. Because it's not, like I look at the housing market with a lot of interest, because in New Zealand in particular, it does genuinely feel like it's like an indicator, right? Of just what is happening within the economy. Because if people see the value of the property going home, they top it up, they spend more money in the economy, it creates like this multiplier effect, but also the wealth effect kicks in. Psychologically, people feel good, like they're going places, even though it's just on paper. But it is important. And I just think about just the social fabric of New Zealand in particular. If we go back to 2016 house prices, I guess my only concern is that you are contracting the money supply in New Zealand. That's significant. But also there's this huge portion of people, right? Like over 8 years, if I can add, 6 years, over 6 years, there's people who would have bought since 2016 who are now paying the price so that a new generation feel like it's more affordable to buy a property, when in reality, no one's going to catch a falling knife. They're going to wait until it finishes correcting. So you got all these delayed effects and all these mismatch of intentions and benefits. And I kind of like your idea.
But you got to think about housing differently, right? Housing is not a traditional, typical financial asset. And people buy houses for very, very different reasons from a financial decision, right? And that's, again, if we come back and we look at the historical data, we show that house prices falling 10%. And I get that's a big number, particularly on a very big number, 15%, 20%. But most people aim to hold a house for over 20, 25 years. And so, look, and this is a very easy thing for someone like me to say, but it is not a big impact in the scheme of things. And I think also people might be holding off, maybe going, I don't want to catch a falling knife. But at the same time, you are seeing rents continuing to increase. People do want to move into a house. People are having kids. There are a whole lot of other reasons that people buy houses apart from the financial reasons. And that's why in New Zealand, what we've seen is the downturns have been very short, very sharp, because, yeah, people kind of go, I actually can't wait any longer and I just need that house.
Hey, we've got a few questions here that I'd love to kind of get onto here. First one up here from James McFarlane. James asks, I thought the stimulus was an election play, not an inflation fix.
James, you are 100% dead right. It was an election play, but actually it was probably an inflation nightmare. I'd say the opposite. So one of the things that the Reserve Bank is trying to do at the moment is stop money going to the economy and getting people to spend a whole lot more. So it definitely was nowhere near an inflation fix. It was actually the opposite of that. And yeah, that's kind of my point, is the last thing you want to be doing when you're trying to bring down inflation is giving people more money to spend.
Which is funny, because it kind of feels like there's still a lot of fiscal stuff going out there in the economy, right? Like, it feels like there's still a lot of government spending going on, right?
Oh, completely. And well, but hey, look, you know, I think a lot of the government spending you can't fault, right? And a lot of it you can't fault. a lot of the stuff on healthcare, core services, a lot of the welfare stuff, you can't really fault a lot of that. It's more those kind of those one-off payments, those one-off things that are going to people. That's the stuff that I kind of have a big issue with, because those are things that aren't necessarily going to make a massive, they will make a difference to some people, whether 2.1 million people need that amount of money, whether it's going to make a material difference to 2.1 million people's lives. That's what I debate. If it is going to make a material difference, great. But as long as we don't see that as another splurge that comes through on inflation. When we saw in the US, they gave out $1,000. You saw the splurge in spending that followed that. And that's just what I want to make sure doesn't happen here.
Yeah, especially when you consider who is getting the extra money. They are more likely to spend it, which is more inflationary, which means that effectively we're all being taxed. Whoever uses the New Zealand dollar gets taxed through inflation. So it's tax on tax. Let's have a chat here with Ethan Roberts. So as a 21-year-old working full-time and saving for a first home, what should I be doing now to make sure I'm prepared in 5 to 10 years? Love this question, Ethan. Do you want to have a go first, and I'll have a go second on this one, Rupert?
Yeah, it's an amazing question, and well played to you, Ethan, for thinking about this as a 21-year-old. I definitely wasn't thinking about this as a 21-year-old, but I'd be a much wealthier person if I had. Look, it really comes down to two things, right? First and foremost, it's figuring out how much you can save. And so as you're thinking through your paycheck and as you're thinking through every week, what can you afford to put away? And whether that be $10 a week, $20 a week, $50 a week, $100 a week, it's about going, what are the sacrifices that you need to make to maximize that dollar? Because the more you can put away each and every week, the better you're going to be when you get to that period. The second thing is, what do you do with that money that you're putting away? If you are 5 to 10 years away, then you can take a relatively aggressive approach to investing. And I think that that's definitely what you should be doing. You will see through at least one market cycle, potentially even two. And so it's about saying, look, I'm willing to take a little bit of risk. I'm willing to take some investments. It's not about gambling. It's not about speculating, but it's about taking balanced risk. So making sure you build yourself out a diversified portfolio of equities, alternative assets, of crypto or other, if you would like to do that, but making sure that you've got well balanced and that you also have it spread over a number of different things. So really it's about those two sides of it, right? One, investing every single week as much as you can, and two, driving as much return out of that saving as you can each and every week as well.
That's great. Like, the only thing I would add to that, like, you nailed it. I probably can't really say much more than that. Ethan, except for that, when you are doing the investment activity, the one thing that I remember doing before I bought my first home, I think there was probably about 12 months where I did spend the amount that I thought it would cost for that new property purchase. Like, I spent the equivalent in mortgage payments for 12 months and I invested that, and that became part of my deposit, which was great. But what I felt was probably the most beneficial thing around that is that it gave me confidence knowing that my cash flow, knowing that my budget was already conditioned and molded around the future world that I was heading into. And so I think part of it is about getting a good investment return. And what Rupert was saying around 5 to 10 years, the longer it is, the more appropriate it is to take risks. That's great. But also just focusing on what that does to your cash flow, because that's going to give you confidence knowing that you can move forward, which you kind of need, especially when you get this crazy volatility in houses. You need to know that you can sustain it. Rupert, before we finish off, what do you think is going to happen? Let's just wildly speculate here as to what's going to happen in the next 12 months with house prices. Go. What do you think?
Look, It's hard to see. I mean, the Economist at the moment talks about New Zealand's the third most at-risk housing market in the world based on a combination of house-to-income ratios, mortgage ratios, etc. So, look, it is hard to see house prices not falling too much further. I think we're also starting to see a little bit of a brain drain again, which is what we saw during that last period in 2009, 2010. So, yeah, unfortunately, I think house prices probably are going to fall a little bit further than where they are today. I think, but be careful though, if anyone's just going to sitting on the sidelines and waiting, because what history tells us is that fall doesn't last too much too long. And I think don't just kind of, yeah, it is going to be an interesting one. But look, if you're like me, you're a homeowner, you're in a house that you expect to be for a very long time. Does it really matter? Probably not. At the end of the day, it's a long-term investment. It's a house. Hopefully you're buying a property, whether that be as an investor or as a homeowner, that you want to be in for 5, 10, 20 years. And fundamentally, it doesn't really matter, because over time, you're going to expect the market to recover and keep on moving up, and it'll kind of work its way through. It's like I say on every single thing when we're talking about where the markets are at, it's really hard to pick the bottom. It's really hard to pick where we're at. But the beauty about housing, it is as long a term investment as you're ever going to get. So you shouldn't worry too much about it.
Cool. Well said. So my two bits on that, just to finish up on, I'll have the last word if that's all right, Rupert.
Always.
I'll just undo everything that you just said. Now, everything that you said was awesome. I'm gonna be bold here and put out there what I think is going to happen, which is really dangerous because I'll probably be wrong. But what the heck, right? So I kind of been thinking a lot about a tick-shaped recovery, right? Where we have a Reserve Bank-induced recession off the back of killing the housing market, which then kills inflation in the process, chemotherapy, which warrants clearly a pullback in the OCR, hopefully getting rid of some of this legislation, specifically the CCCFA that's restricting lending activity. And I think the recovery will be substantial. I think that people will be surprised by how fast the housing market rebounds. It'll give us whiplash. It'll be that fast. It's not a V-shaped recovery. It's a tick-shaped recovery. And I can see that unfolding possibly within the next 12 months. What really gives me encouragement today by seeing the official cash rate spike up so much like what it did means that we are going to go there so much faster now, which means that the recovery is going to be so much sooner. That's my two bits. Now, hopefully I'll just wait and see that I'm wrong, right?
I agree with you, by the way. I think you're right. It'll happen quickly, and the Reserve Bank will have to move a lot quicker in the recovery phase than anyone's predicting.
Yeah, cool. Let's see what happens. All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening in. Thanks again, James and Ethan, for your questions. By all means, ask away during the week and we'll pull up the questions if we remember, or just ask a question next time you see us. Next week, 5:30 here on Facebook and on YouTube. Make sure that you're following us in those two places. Thanks very much, Rupert from Kura KiwiSaver. We'll catch you next week.
Thanks, Darcy. Thanks, everyone.